I would trade him if I could.
I don't think many people liked it, to be honest. I don't care.
Last year didn't really do well for anybody.
We should probably delete all of this.
By the laws of the podcast gods, we owe an answer.
Reporting the Highline with Rabbi in Red. Talking the rapids and turning heads. With questions from you and analysis. In your car or in your home. Thank you for tuning to Holding the Highline.
Hey Rapids fans, you're listening to Holding the High Line with Rabbi in Red, brought to you by Icarus FC and Roughneck Scarves. My name's Matt Pollard. It's Wednesday, June 3rd, 2020, even though it feels like 30-30. It's been 83 days since MLS suspended the 2023 season. Earlier today, the MLSPA voted and approved the new CBA with contingencies for the Orlando mini tournament that had been much reported on and several other protections for both players and the league given the uncertainty surrounding 2020. Many parties on both sides have acknowledged that years of built up good relations and faith were abandoned through this entire process as the league and team owners really played hardball with the players and even threatened a lockout going into the beginning of this week. And on a much more important note and macro point, since we are an American soccer podcast, America is still grappling with the death of George Floyd, an unarmed black man who is accused of using a counterfeit bill and who was killed in Minnesota last Monday when a white police officer put his knee to Floyd's neck while Floyd was on the ground for several minutes. This has sparked protests around the country, including in Denver, with varying degrees of peaceful protests as well as rioting and destruction of property. Denver still has a curfew in place at time of recording. The United States is now grappling with a 100-year pandemic event, the worst unemployment in the country since the Great Depression, and division over elevated pressures to come to terms with and resolve historic and still very present systematic racism against people of color. I'm joined now by a man who is the light in dark places for me and dark times, Rabbi Mark Goodman. Mark, to quote Smash Mouth ironically, my world's on fire, how about yours?
Somebody once told me the world is going to roll me. He says with a mouthful of almonds.
Yes, and we ain't the sharpest podcast in the shed, that's for certain, Mark.
We do okay. We're not so bad. I mean, Matt was like, hey, we need to, but before we start, he's like, hey, we need to address the events. Even though we need to also make a disclaimer, so I'm just going to like say the thing we talked about before. We need to make a disclaimer that this is not the destination for this topic, which is really interesting because I think like we have listeners who've reached out to us and said, you guys are really thoughtful on big issues and serious stuff and we really appreciate it. So, I guess my only comment is because I had to spend like 3 hours trying to write a letter to my tiny little congregation here in Pennsylvania. And just to wrap my mind around like, well, what do I say? Well, so, I mean, everybody out there in, podcast listener land has already read the statement of some corporate entity trying to come up with PR speak that doesn't sound totally ridiculous. And like, you know, from the totally most banal statement in the world, for instance, from Major League Soccer, who didn't really stand, or actually Major League Soccer did okay. If you really want a bland, nothing burger statement, try the NFL. Their statement is like pretty much gibberish word speak. And also, I'll be real blunt. I called out the Colorado Rapids for using a whole bunch of PR language and doublespeak. You know, I mean, it would be nice if what they had written was sound and fury. It wasn't even sound or fury. It just signified nothing. But on the other end, you get Ben and Jerry's, who basically said, we need to systematically destroy the structures of racism in America that we've had for 400 years. So like, you know, as a rabbi, you split the difference between there. And you hope, most importantly, here's the thing I was going to say. You hope you give people marching orders as opposed to platitudes, right? You hope you can say to someone, here's who you are. Here's what I know about you. Here's what you can do, right? If you were a Sears customer, you could say to someone like, we're going to make sure that the next time you buy a vacuum from Sears, that black-owned businesses went into it and that prison labor didn't support it, right? On Major League Soccer's end, you might want to say, we know our front offices aren't that diverse. We're going to try harder to make them more diverse. And so for my congregants, you know, I say, think about the conversations you have. Think about the places you donate money. Think about the way that you vote. And all of those things should be touched by how black people are treated in America, how black people have been treated in America. You know, like the Colorado Rapids did an amazing thing this past year by hiring a black coach, right? And that's a great step. It's not the end of a journey any more than making Barack Obama the president of the United States didn't end racism. So, you know, one of the things we say in my religion is that a person should always be mefas fesbus bema'asab. They should always be like searching of their deeds. And just because you woke up this morning and you had a good day and you did some good things and you were a good person doesn't mean you don't wake up tomorrow and say, what can I do better? My friend, and then I'll stop. My friend Jeremy is, he's very like into the, like the management books. Like he reads all the Who Moves My Cheese, you know, seven effective highly method of, you know, people who move cheese, things like that. And he talks about, he's been talking in the last couple weeks about being 1% better, that like being 1% worse each day only marginally affects how much worse you get. But being 1% better because of the exponential growth rate has a huge impact on how you are. Imagine if as a society, organizations, police forces, the federal government, soccer teams, and each individual committed to being 1% better every day and thinking about like, how could I be 1% better towards people of color who I might look at them one way and make snap judgments, but I might more accurately think about how they've been systematically disenfranchised and disadvantaged throughout American history.
Well said on that front, Mark. I'll double it up. I would say certainly you have perspective, I think, given your religion and your choice of profession based on your religion, kind of how people throughout history and current society in our lifetimes have approached Judaism. I would say certainly I'd say for in excess of, you know, the majority of our audience right now, given who either soccer or general other podcasts you have, I'm probably one of the least qualified people to be talking about this. Like, Mark, if we remove the fact that you're a Jew and Judaism has largely been a maligned religion in the last 100 years in the history of the planet, we're two white heterosexual cisgender guys who grew up in relatively well-to-do, at least, you know, somewhere in the middle class range environments in terms of our households. We're both pretty well educated. I don't want to speak for you, but at least I, through merit scholarships and other support from my parents and everything, was doing okay. You know, I would say if it wasn't for the billionaires and the multi, you know, and the $100 million people, you know, I am at best in the bottom 5% in terms of people who can and should be talking about this, you know, with a little bit of census data and maybe a little bit knowing more about my situation, somebody could look up the stats and everything and say, Matt, you're actually in the bottom 2% at best, and you're probably right. So I think I'm still not sure what the right thing to say or do in some of these situations are, but I definitely want to help be a part of the solution. And I think that starts with not being a racist, but condemning racism and in, as you articulated, with your actions, with your thought, both micro and macro, and certainly with your wallet, need to take actions that inhibit or don't promote or enable racist behaviors and racist actions. So I would say to any person of color who maybe wants to provide a little bit more perspective, or just anybody in this, I hear you. I acknowledge your pain and I empathize with it, knowing that I have no idea what it's like to be black in America. I want to help, and you matter. And so my DMs are open at LWS Matt Pollard on Twitter, rapids96podcast@gmail.com. If you just want to, if you want to vent, if you just want to be heard, if you have ideas how either in a soccer context or in another context, we could do that, or we, you know, we could help be, you know, part of the solution rather than part of the problem, please absolutely reach out to us. And if you have any particularly grassroots information or suggestions on where people, you know, most of our audience is in Colorado, so, you know, have suggestions on how people can be more active in the greater Front Range, if you provide us information on that, we will absolutely amplify that on all channels. But I don't feel we as a podcast and we as a platform, I feel like could not acknowledge that more. And I think to your point, Mark, about, you know, the club kind of being pretty vanilla and not stepping on any toes, I think the outspoken members of the soccer community in America have been very front on this one. I don't know if you saw, but earlier today, Mark, the Bundesliga, whatever their equivalent of the disciplinary committee is, like an MLS, came out and decided to rescind the fines and potential punishments toward Jadon Sancho, Weston McKennie, and a few other players who had various actions throughout the weekend in terms of, I think Jadon Sancho scored a goal and took off his shirt, and then on his undershirt, it said his yellow plain Dortmund undershirt, it said justice for George Floyd. Weston McKennie had a white armband that he wore that said justice for George Floyd, and the league decided to, anybody who received a card for that rescinded those cards, and anybody who was subject to a panel review for a potential fine or suspension decided to not punish any of the players on that front. And so, you know, Kai Kamara had an Instagram live, I think, with CJ Sapong earlier this week that I'd recommend you guys checking out, that I think he also put on his Twitter account. We've also seen comments from other players. There was a really heartfelt Twitter thread that DeAndre Yedlin put out. So I think it's nice to see the players of color in American soccer and MLS certainly come out and be voices to that. And I think certainly the league has been, you know, has been receptive to hearing that and understanding that, even if action hasn't necessarily been promised on that front, Mark. You know, I think certainly the Soccer for All, Don't Cross the Line has been a good initiative to be welcoming. I was profoundly relieved earlier, I think it was on Monday, Mark, when Extra Time came out and basically just dedicated the episode to the events of the past weekend. And Charlie Davies basically said, you know, at no point in this league as a player, in terms of teammate interactions, opponent, coaches, or fans, have I experienced any racism. Was extremely relieving on that front. So I think certainly to the, you know, the press releases from the NFL and their franchises in San Francisco and Washington, respectively, being pretty tone deaf and not really understanding how, you know, just putting out a press release and a tweet relative to their actions aren't there, I at least have seen somewhat of a positive front on that in MLS, Mark. And I look forward to you and I, as members of the Rapids community and members of the American soccer community, being activists towards dealing with this on and off the pitch going forward.
Yeah, I'll just add, if another great set of tweets you should take a look at if you get a chance is Derek Etienne Jr.
Yes.
Who plays for the Red Bulls. And he pointed out that he got pulled over twice on the same day in New York City and was somewhat harassed by New York City police. It made me think a lot about – so here in Pittsburgh, we had a white player – step up and make some really remarkably wonderful statements about his obligation and his responsibility to do something on behalf of his black fellow players. You know, one of the things that's difficult for the American athlete is if a cop pulls over LeBron James, he goes, oh crap, it's LeBron James, right? If a police officer pulls over Lalas Abubakar, he will not know who he is. He will see a very large black individual, and his immediate...
whose accent will probably immediately give him away that he's not, you know, born and raised in this country, potentially.
Right, but more importantly, he probably will see him as, this guy's big, and he's a threat, and then he will add to that and compound it, potentially, possibly. Some police officers, not all. By saying he is black and therefore I'm going to increase my threat level arbitrarily because society has trained me to do that. Like, one of the things that's, you know, I know we're going down the rabbit hole again, but one of the things that's really difficult for me in this situation is you know, we've really seen during these protests that police have some fantastic gear. You know, they're absolutely kitted out with all the shields and all the riot helmets and all the body armor. And what if they had spent all that money on training instead, you know? And what if they had spent that money on buying proper PPE for hospital workers in the possibility of a pandemic coming up? I know I'm like thinking about possible hypotheticals that are really, you know, like Americans should have been able to be clairvoyant a year ago. But, you know, back to my original point, it's one thing to say, it's scary to see your black friends in America have to put up with a different set of rules that they have to abide by. But it's another thing to look down the bench at your fellow teammates on your soccer team and say, like, when I drive home, I'm white and I can trust that I'll get home and not have to worry about anything. And I can't necessarily say that in the same to the same degree about my black teammates. And I think that that's one of those ways in which the rubber meets the road in Major League Soccer and for all the professional sports, because they have such significant African-American and in Lawless Abubakar, since he's African and not American, black participation. You know, it's really important that teams step up as teams.
Want to give a shout out to something completely unrelated, Mark, which is we are currently, you know, a little over halfway through the semifinal round of the Holding the High Line vote for the best Rapids jersey of all time. In the semifinals, we have the, all blue original, Colorado state flag jersey from 2013 taking on the season ticket holder striped burgundy and white. And then on the other side, we have the burgundy and blue of the previous 2 years, so 2018, 2019, taking on the all yellow and blue shorted Colorado state flag jerseys. So that vote is still up on our Twitter page. It's in a thread that is pinned to our Twitter page at Rapids96Podcast. Mark, your thoughts on the current state of our jersey vote and the fact that it's, you know, I was a little surprised that the old school jerseys from the 1900s didn't make it very far. But if you look at it, basically none of the white kits survived the first round. And I think it's been pretty firm from all of our voters that they love the Colorado flag color jerseys and they love the burgundy jerseys.
Yeah, I'm pulling it up right now to get the results currently so that I can know what exactly we're talking about. I think you pretty much made that point. I also noticed MLS stole our idea and did the same thing. First round was basically, you know, your team's best jersey, and then after that it was kind of knockout. And I knew that the Rapids kits were going to get knocked out at some point.
I mean, it was a popularity contest, Mark. Like, it was a Seattle, I think the final, which was three jerseys, was the old school, sometime in the 90s, the Revolution, like, spiraling star kit that they had that was a third kit. And then it was an Atlantic kit and a Seattle kit. Like, if you put any MLS vote on Twitter at this point, like, all it takes is the social media intern from the Sounders or Atlanta United, maybe one of the LA teams, to retweet it. And then just those fan bases out of their size are going to hijack it. And I don't trust those votes.
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite things about our poll is that the 2010 kit did really well. I don't think the 2010 kit is that remarkable. I think a lot of people are emotional
about
it. Because they won the league that year. I was definitely a little bit disappointed that nothing green survived, right? Am I right on that? That, like, all the green kits got killed?
We had one green kit. The green one with, like, the black stripe going from the top to the sides made it to the second round. And surprisingly, Mark, the quarterfinals, both blue and black kits that I would say, I mean, we've talked about this a couple of weeks ago, I think, like, name another team in MLS or even in world football, really, who, if we're talking about the first burgundy kit we see, I think is in 07, you're talking about in 11 years, like, four different distinct jerseys from the white and the green and the gold, kind of just completing out the color palette in MLS. Then you got the blue and the black. Then you got the solid green shirt and the black jersey. And then you've got the burgundy jersey with varying secondary kits, Colorado Frag related, or boring white since then in just 11 years. So, I mean, the Rapids have a paint, like, have the entire color wheel at this point, but I agree with you in terms of my disappointment that the blue and black kits made it so far and that the old school, the green and black, and then the even older, like, 96, 97 kits were basically knocked out in the second round.
Yeah, I think my favorite green kit didn't make it past the first round, which is the green with the kind of swirls down the side, which is to kind of like offset it.
Yeah, I know which one you're talking about. I was disappointed
in
that one.
I can't find it. I feel like it's like 97. It's really old, and I think it's a Kappa jersey.
But, yeah, it would have been. I think I have there's a really big photo from, or a really at least famous in terms of the ones I looked up for, of Getty Images of Marcella Balboa on the ball. And then I think it was the 97 MLS Cup at RFK. It's just really iconic from what I remember looking back at the photos. But I agree with you, Mark, that I'm disappointed that the MLS 1.0 era kits didn't really make it that far. I'm not surprised that our semifinal is an all burgundy, all Colorado State flag matchup.
Yeah, I mean, I think my favorite kit of all is the electric blue. And it's shocking because I don't own it. And I kind of am like, this, one of the things that's really dangerous about this, this kit competition is you look at a kit and you're like, ooh, I don't own that one. I should own that one. Let's go on eBay. And then you make some irresponsible decisions. And there's nothing I wear less than soccer kits. Matt wears his soccer kits a lot. Like right now he's wearing his Nigeria kit. From the last was it from the last one or from 8 years ago?
It was the 2018 World Cup. So this is the kind of stripy green and white one that kind of goes up and down. I think Twitter co-opted it as the Wakanda Forever kit.
Yeah, and this makes me want the green one. I only have two Rapids, like really proper Rapids kits. I have a full on yellow and blue, which, you know, is really a great one and I really enjoy. And then I have a burgundy that's a replica jersey, that I think is a replica of the 2014-15 season. It doesn't say Chow on the front cover though, because that would be super awesome. But yeah, I feel, you know, like if in the end the electric blue wins, it'll be a huge coup because like the conventional wisdom is one of the burgundy kits is destined to win. The fact that I guess the last thing I'll say on the matter is the fact that the black and blues made it farther than the greens is probably the only shock for me in the whole series.
Yeah, agree with you, Mark. So voting is still up if you still want to vote, folks. We've been tweeting and retweeting about it pretty much daily from @Rapids96Podcast. So head on over to our Twitter page, and then you see we have the entire thread, the first tweet, tagged to it. And then I will drop the final thread this coming Sunday, and we'll make that a week long. So we'll see what it ends up being, Mark. It's pretty neck and neck, so it could be Colorado versus a burgundy. It could be an all-Colorado. It could be an all-burgundy. But in any case, I still think even though I agree with you, Mark, that some of our favorite kits didn't make it that far, we've got four really great jerseys in the semifinals, and I think no matter who ends up being the winner, it's going to be a kit that's iconic and certainly synonymous with the Pits. Let's move on to something else, Mark. You, in the last couple weeks, finally finished Sunderland Till I Die. Spoiler alerts for those of you who, I guess, for some reason are listening to this and Sunderland Till I Die Season 2 was not at or near the top of your quarantine binge-watching list, so I will put a timestamp in the show notes if you want to skip through if you haven't seen this on spoiler alert, a soccer season for a club that ended a year ago now and a series that's been out for over 2 months. But Mark, your thoughts overall on season two and just what became of Sunderland AFC?
I mean, I did not know what happened in the end. I knew that
I didn't look anything up, and I would implore listeners who haven't finished it not to look up stuff. It is way more intriguing and hold on to your butts and exciting if you don't look up anything throughout the season as to what happened either with the transfer window or the end of the season, both in the cup and in the league.
I suppose. I mean, I'm currently reading a book where I knew that the ending was semi-spoiled, and then I went and looked up all the endings anyways, which is Michelle McNamara, Patton Oswalt's wife, wrote a book called I'll Be Gone in the Dark, which is about the Golden State Killer. So no spoilers here about that. But anyways, you know, it's knowledge is a dangerous thing, and that's just how it had to be. I think the thing I like most about Sunderland is they're so similar to the Rapids, but they have some big differences in the sense that when you get twice relegated, you're thinking about downsizing and scaling yourself down, and the Rapids are constantly thinking about scaling themselves up. But they're constantly both kind of thinking about, like, you know, marketing angles and, like, you know, ticket sales and the constant conversation by the whatever the guy's name is, who's the equivalent of the general manager, is a really, he's just like absolutely fixated on ticket sales, ticket sales, ticket sales. And it's really fascinating because I think the Rapids is the same way, that the idea is if we can't be good, at least we can be profitable, which is a really funny kind of way of looking at soccer. I think most professional sports teams would say, if we win, we'll find a way to be profitable. If we can't win, then there's no point to the rest of the endeavor. And I thought that was an interesting aspect of Sunderland.
Yeah, no, well said, Mark. I'm looking up who you were referring to in terms of, why don't you look up the personnel. I guess just in comparing, and I think I talked about this a couple weeks ago, but I'll reprise it again anyways, just in case, that I thought season one was very technically focused. And I know the technical director that they had, the guy who was fully bald, who ends up departing the club between season one and season two. Mark, did you find him? Or no?
Not yet.
Okay. I'll keep talking. And so, you know, that he ends up being a really technical person, but then there was also, like, there wasn't a person on the business side. And so I thought season two did a really good job, albeit with not a main narrator interviewee who was an actual technical person. So, I mean, if I were doing this about the Rapids, for example, I'd like the three most important non-players I'd want in this would be Robin Fraser, Porrick Smith, and Wayne Brandt, for example. And so we got so much technical stuff and not really on the business side in season one, albeit with an owner who was very distant from the club and ultimately ends up selling the club between season one. And that leads into the real intrigue with season two, with the team confirming relegation to the English third division. And then we kind of got a nice little balance between the, well, we've got to increase ticket sales and how do we balance things out? And, oh, you know, we had a cryo recovery machine at the training facility that it turns out none of the players ended up using. And that thing costs like £10,000. So if we sell that, and there's 100 different instances of those. And we had a really interesting head coach who was trying to deal with things and had really interesting technical plans. So we could kind of see, you know, we could see the business side and the marketing side of, you know, we're going to Wembley. This is an opportunity for us in a final to clear $1 million on a day. Our operating budget is £18 million for the entire season. So for the opportunity for us to do that and win the first trophy since the FA Cup, which a lot of fans weren't alive for, it was really interesting to see both sides, but we didn't really have a designated technical person. So I don't know if there just wasn't a general manager or a technical director in that side, but I'm increasingly surprised, Mark, and this is true, I think, of sports leagues and sports teams all over the world, of appointing non-technically qualified people because ownership is in control. So if I take a look, for example, the Dallas Cowboys, for example, who are owned by Jerry Jones, appointed himself as general manager. He's a great business guy. I'm sure he'd be a great director of business operations. I don't know that he should be deciding whether, you know, he should be negotiating and deciding the performance bonuses behind the contract offer extension that they're going to make to Dak Prescott. You know, and I say that, of course, as a supporter of Fulham FC, where Shahir Khan's son, albeit some guy who went to college and almost got his PhD in data science, is running the Moneyball side of the front office. Even though he's not the technical director, he is running the analytics side of Fulham. So I thought that was really interesting just from a structure standpoint. And obviously, just if you like the last three episodes for me, which I think are the one on the January transfer window where they get a resolution to the situation with their star striker who emerged as a big part of the team in the first half of the season. Then we get the final with the Cheka trade trophy, it's a lower league knockout turn, basically take out the Premier League, and it's an FA Cup for all the lower division teams. So they go to Wembley, and then you have the playoff final, and then them getting back to Wembley. Those three episodes, from a film standpoint, were magnificently done, perfectly timed. I was on the edge of my seat, and I just, to your point, Mark, where there's a lot of similarities in terms of experiencing what it's like to care about the Rapids to what the Sunderland fans who we followed for the first two seasons experienced. There's just universal experiences of the range of emotions you can experience throughout an entire season, and just an individual game as a soccer fan that they do a fantastic job of encapsulating, both on the macro scale and on the small level of individual fans, whether it's Chris Camus, the guy with the beard who spray paints his beard, the taxi driver guy who gets his hair cut, and then a few other fans they have, was just magnificently done. In terms of, this is from a style standpoint, I kind of prefer that to the tried and true method that, say, Hard Knocks or, All or Nothing have done in the past. But it's a great film in terms of a documentary standpoint. They have two great storylines and narratives in each of the two seasons, but just getting to kind of see every side of the elephant was really well done. I would have liked to see more of a technical front, whether that was more of the guy who's the head of scouting or something from season two. And I mean, to that point, Mark, if the Rapids were to ever do that, I think I'd want equal representation between Wayne Brandt, Porrick Smith, and Robin Fraser. And we just didn't really get that. And maybe that was just because of the narrative. Like, Lyndon Gooch was a big part and a starter of this team. I don't know that at any point in the two seasons we actually get an interview shot of Lyndon Gooch talking to the camera.
Right. Yeah. And I think, there's a narrow focus, and that's okay, I think, a little bit, because I have a feeling they picked a couple of players who were compelling, interesting interviews or compelling, interesting stories. Josh Maja was not a very good interview, but they interviewed him anyways because he became an interesting story. But that was a great example of what you and I go through, which is that, like, we have to interview people who don't necessarily do a great job being interviewed, but there's a compelling story behind what's going on there.
Mark, I have a question for you, to your point. Josh Maja has an interesting narrative from the beginning of the season to the end of the season. And there's a point where there's some uncertainty and they're kind of building a drama around that narrative. And Maja is interviewed a few times. I was watching this, and I was watching it separately from my dad because he was in California at the time. But then we were looking at it, and he looking at me from the journo. He actually, every time we met somebody and we talked about the PSG game last November when we went to the game, he pointed out, like, yeah, my son's a soccer journalist in America and everything. Like, he went to me and said, Matt, what do you think? I think during one or two of the interviews that Josh Maja has, he immediately gives away which way he's leaning and ultimately the resolution to his situation. What did you think at the time, not knowing in real life what happens to Josh Maja, of that interview and whether or not he had a good poker face?
I mean, he didn't, but I think my favorite part of that whole fight is how the owner, Stuart something or other.
Stuart Donald.
And by the way, the general manager-y guy I was talking about, his name is Charlie Methven. So Stuart is so upset. And also, when he's trying to sign Will Grigg, he's like so like crazed about it. And it all seems like, he seems a little bit like a noob. You know, he seems a little bit like kind of not totally sophisticated in his dealings. Like, they're so bitterly complaining about, agents and how agents want to make the move so that they can run up the price. And it's like, yeah, you're a third division club and this kid's getting a sniff from first division teams in France. You bet your butt he's going to leave. And instead of having a conversation, like, the owner was having this constant, conversation about how unfair it was and how these agents are the death of the game. Instead of spending all this time planning and plotting and thinking, like, we can get a really good price for him. And then on the back end, They are absolutely, you know, hung out to dry, and they're desperate, and they have to vastly overpay for Will Grigg, who isn't that great a striker. You know, he's fine, but he's nothing special. It was a little bit comical. Like, I think between Maja leaving and Grigg coming, I was like, I think that was like episode 6 of the 8 episodes or something like that. At that point, I was kind of like, yeah, I don't think they're going up. Like, like they don't seem to really know how this works. Like, they basically downgraded at striker over the window. And it was like, yeah, you guys are barely hanging on to fourth, and now you got worse. So, you know, if you lose the transfer window badly enough, like, you're definitely not getting promoted. It's like the same in MLS. Like, if you hit August 5th usually is when the window closes, and you got worse over the window, you shed a couple players and you didn't really pick much up, and you're barely on that last rung for playoffs, you're not going to make it. That's it. Like, it's pretty simple.
Yeah, no, we'll set on that front, Mark. But I think to your point, I would love to see more, not even an entire document series of just like, whether it's an MLS team or a Premier League team, just like go in, give us unfettered access to film you through the January transfer window, and then especially through that final day with how hectic that can be. They did a great job, the producers of Sooner Until I Die, both in season 1 of season 2, of encapsulating that insanity in the final hours of it. And then also there's a really good one of the episodes of Take Us Home, the Amazon series on Leeds United last season, as they're pushing to, you know, not pull a Leeds and actually get promoted to the Premier League for the first time in however many years, of just encapsulating that raw. So, you know, whether it's Manchester United, I'd be willing to do it with the Rapids, maybe not this transfer window as we'll get to it, Mark, but I mean, just like, give me unfettered access, and I promise all of that stuff lays dormant for 2 full seasons, or until everything that would have happened at that point gets resolved. And then I release just what is that like? Because to your point, Matt, Mark, just like seeing Stuart Donald in that situation, somewhat of a novice from a technical side of things, and then kind of dealing with the, you know, one player's out and they know that they want us, you know, the team's trying, you know, is constantly driving up the price and everything. That's the stuff that I think fans and just the media in general is the least understood, is the most covered up in terms of the soccer world, that I think if we could just blow that open and better understand it, I think we'd have a much better understanding, appreciation of, and empathy for the front office people when things don't work out. Like, I would have loved to at the time been in the room, even off the record, to just understand everything that went into the Dombaji trade for Kellen Acosta and what that looked like, or, you know, the Lalas Abubakar transfer last summer, or what the negotiations were like to actually get the terms and conditions to get Nomly to the Rapids. That stuff fascinates me. It's one of the ones that I think is most critical to understanding the sport, and it's one of the ones that we least get the curtain pulled back on to understand. And I thought in both seasons, but especially in season 2 of Sunderland Till I Die, they did it fantastically. Okay, Mark, let's move forward. We have the second and last episode of the season, which is the Cheka trade final against Portsmouth at Wembley Stadium. And then in the final episode, we go through that sees them replay Portsmouth in the playoff semifinal, and then ultimately play, I think it was Charlton Athletic, in the final itself. I have experienced the highs and lows of a playoff system. I don't know that there's a... Certainly MLS Cup playoffs, Mark, but there is nothing quite like those promotion playoffs that go on in just in terms of the insanity that is capable of happening from the 2 semifinal legs to the actual game at Wembley and everything. Fulham obviously had that in a good way 2 seasons ago when they managed to survive Aston Villa just a couple weeks ago, 2 years ago now. Mark, your thoughts on those final 2 episodes and just the entire... spanning the gambit of human emotions that you feel in those final 2 hours of the season?
I think what I liked about it, I don't have a lot of thought, because I think actually the show really peaked kind of beginning middle. But I think what was best about it was just that it's as close to reliving, to experiencing real soccer as we had gotten during this pandemic break. So I have watched a little bit of Bundesliga, but the Bundesliga is always hard to get invested in because it's a two-horse race from the beginning of the season, and Dortmund always blows it. And I think that that's it. You know, it's like I don't know if there's been when the last time it was that wasn't the case. So all I have to look forward to this year in the Bundesliga is seeing whether Mainz gets relegated or not. And right now, based on their last 2 weeks, boy, they look like they're going down. They look terrible. But they always pull a rabbit out of their hat. Mainz is kind of miraculous that way. But with Sunderland, it felt like I said, they had kind of blown it at the transfer window, and I just wasn't getting my hopes up. And they definitely let down as I expected. And I feel like that was, as a Colorado Rapids fan, that felt pretty familiar. You know, just kind of like, especially like last season, we were so pummeled at the beginning of the year. And then the year kind of went on and things got a little bit better. And then the year got better and better. And we were starting to think like, well, we haven't been eliminated from the playoffs yet. Maybe something miraculous happens. And in my head, I just kept saying, they'll blow it. They'll blow it, you know, eventually. But they really, I mean, the Rapids waited till the last game of the season to blow it. It's pretty remarkable. It's pretty great. So Sunderland is a little bit similar, which was like the buildup was at the beginning. I was kind of like, well, they're in fourth. They've let Maja go. Things aren't going very well. They're going to blow it, but I'm interested to see how they blow it.
We've got an Ask HTHL going back to April 30th from Jared Thornburg, Mark. Shout out Jared for, giving us the YouTube version of your, recording of the Rapids 2010 game against the Philadelphia Union over the last couple weeks that Mark and I finally did a commentary of, Mark. So Jared tweeted us a question mark, and it includes a couple screenshots, I believe, of that January transfer episode of Sun Until I Die that in the background included a map of the United States with several pins of varying colors, and one of the pins just happens to be in red around the Front Range of Colorado. We also have pins in you can see it mirrors MLS teams in red and then yellow for some of the USL teams. We also have a couple pins around New Orleans, so it's not quite sure what this makes sense, but this is in the office at the, not the Stadium of Light. What is it, Mark? The Academy of Light, I think it is. Does that sound right? In any case, finally getting through Sunderland Till I Die. Why do they have a map of the United States, and who are they scouting in Wyoming? The pin is kind of close to the Wyoming border, but in any case, Mark, and then we had a couple comments that they could have been referring to Tommy Smith. Anything north of Denver might as well be DSGP, or maybe they were in Greeley or Cheyenne. But in any case, Mark, your thoughts on whether or not potentially in January of last year, Sunderland's front office was already scouting to see whether or not they could inevitably sign now current Black Cat Tommy Smith?
Could be. I don't know. Yeah, who's from Greeley? Don't the Rapids have a player who was originally from?
Courtney Ford went to high school in Greeley. He went to the rival high school, Richard Terry, actually.
Could be scouting Courtney Ford, although that wouldn't make much sense. But I don't know. It's a crazy idea. It's a crazy idea. But yeah, it is. You buried the lead there, which was Tommy Smith is currently with Sunderland, which if they do, are they doing Sunderland season 3?
They are not currently recording this season. Producers and everything are actually Sunderland fans, so they have the club view at heart, but kind of the consensus was that it wasn't really interesting. The impetus behind season 1 was, you know, the rebirth, you know, the Phoenix Rising, so to speak, soccer USL team pun intended there, with season 1 of going down to the championship and trying to get re-promoted. Obviously, that turns into a fantastic story for all the wrong reasons, and then it was a further rebirth, but it was also new coach, new front office. You know, we need to get this thing turned around now, Mark. And basically what we know now is that just it was very much a repeat of the storyline, and the storyline wasn't new or different enough for them to warrant doing it. And there just didn't seem as much interest in terms of, not they wanted to fully shut them out, but the sense from a couple of the press releases and other things, nuggets that I pulled up, there just wasn't as much interest to give them as unfettered access, given that it had kind of grown stale having them around, and the narrative just wasn't as interesting. You know, in a lot of ways, the Sunderland Till I Die kind of makes a lot of people who were involved with Sunderland look bad in the first two seasons, and I definitely don't think, as soft as we kind of saw Stuart Donald capable of being at times, that he wanted another another year of that and people knowing if you push him on a striker that he kind of sort of wants, you can get an extra $1.5 million out of him. That's not something that I don't think you want to project when you're still playing in League One.
Yeah, I think you said it well, which is like, you know, the dramatic collapse and the long, slow climb back to the top. If there's no long, slow climb, there's not really as much drama. But, you know, I think I wonder whether Netflix has found this sports documentary system is good. I will say that by comparison to the Michael Jordan documentary, The Last Dance, I like Sunderland more. I think Sunderland Until I Die is a little bit more complex. I think it's a little bit richer. They got a lot of different opinions, whereas The Last Dance is ultimately the story of Michael Jordan and how Michael Jordan won 6 championships through Michael Jordan's eyes as told by Michael Jordan. You know, it's like, and sure, there's some, in fact, the best stories, the most compelling stories were when they got away from him, when they spent some time on Dennis Rodman and
Steve. You didn't think Pizzagate was interesting, Mark?
No. I actually cried when Steve Kerr told his father's story, and I knew that story, and I'd read articles about that story. It wasn't a surprise to me, but just seeing the video of his father, I mean, he's a really brilliant and eloquent individual who really saw some hard times. And it was the question they used to pivot to the story was brilliant, which was, you know, going from Michael Jordan to Steve Kerr, who both lost their fathers, and the fact that neither of them really talked about that. It was kind of neat. So those kinds of moments made the show really good. But overwhelmingly, like, you know, especially at the end where it was like, you know that the Bulls are going to win again, but they're going to kind of tease us with it anyways.
We've talked maybe unofficially in the past, Mark, about having, like, you know, an on the record holding the high line reading list, given the books that we've referenced in the history of this podcast. So I think we should, I'm going to motion now to unanimously create a holding the high line soccer watch list. And I'm going to nominate the first series or documentary or movie to put on that watch list, Sunderland Till I Die. Mark, do I have a yay vote?
Absolutely.
Okay. Last question that I have, Mark. After I finished the series, I think I tweeted this and tagged you in it, but I had a dream that you and I were filming and producing season 3 of Sunderland Till I Die. Sunderland makes it back to Wembley in the promotion playoff. They need a goal to win in stoppage time, and it ends up being that they win a corner, they take a short corner, and Lyndon Gooch crosses the ball into Tommy Smith, who scores on a thumping header, and Sunderland go up. League One's been abandoned, right? I think so.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so Mark, I'm going to put Blood Pact right here. If in the 2020-2021 season, Sunderland makes it to the playoff final at Wembley, and if they score to advance in stoppage time, either regular time or extra time, and it ends up being Lyndon Gooch with the assist to Tommy Smith, we have to go in on Sunderland kits. Which one of us is getting Lyndon Gooch on the back, and which one of us is getting Tommy Smith on the back?
Oh. I don't want either of them, man. I just feel like...
I'll buy them. I'll pay for them, Mark.
Nice. All right. I guess I'll take Gooch.
Okay. Lyndon Gooch to you. I'm taking Tommy Smith. All right.
I want Honeywell. That's what I want.
I don't think he's on the team anymore, is he?
Really?
Or is it Honeyman? I thought it was Honeyman. Yeah, I think he got sold and everything. Okay. So in any case, Mark, let's move to the MLS news of the week, which is, of course, finally we have a resolution to what things are going to look like for MLS in 2020. The MLS Players Association voted on Tuesday night and then ultimately they needed a majority. We don't know the details of it, but they got a majority and ratified the second or the third iteration of the deal that the MLS, the league, and the owners put forward to them. This includes a 7.5 5% pay cut across the year. And there's a couple of other things that affect players who make more than a certain amount of money. But, you know, if we're talking about just the academy kids on a homegrown deal, or if you're on the league minimum, it's just 7.5%. There's a little bit more complications for the TAM players and the designated players. Not sure how this is going to affect young DP Brian Galvan if and when he arrives with the club, which is still scheduled to be at the start of the secondary transfer window, which at time of recording is still set to be July 7th, about a month away. This also includes the Orlando tournament that we had talked about, and so players will be going to that. They do have stipulations to make that okay. Players have the option to opt out of it, but with a potential penalty, and then effectively a lot of the TV deals and revenue sharing that was set to take place further down the line in the CBA mark effectively just got extended. So now we have the CBA all the way through January 31st of 2026. So into the calendar year in which the United States, Mexico, and Canada will be hosting the three-country hosting an expanded World Cup format. This includes the TV deals, and there's also the players are taking less of that money up front, but then will still be going to it. So I know there was a lot of hullabaloo about effectively that the owners in the league chose to play hardball, and effectively all the winnings that the players got from the CBA negotiations in January were undone. That's not really happening. There's some short-term reductions in terms of the bells and whistles the players were going to get, and a lot of the future benefits and earnings and revenue sharing that they were going to get was just pushed a year down the line. So the players are still going to get to that point that they had agreed to in January. It's just going to be a little bit slower getting there, and ultimately it's going to take through to an extra year. On the plus side now, Mark, you know, the CBA is ratified through the World Cup. And I've got to believe that, you know, I would hope that we don't have a league lockout going into the year in which, in which MLS and America are hosting a World Cup. So I would assume there'd be significant impetus for them to not have the CBA expire so that on February 1st, 2026, that's the situation. But Mark, your thoughts on all the stuff that we've seen coming out from The Athletic and ESPN and the rambles that I had on just the fact that we're going to see soccer. It's going to be non-zero, but, you know, the players and relationships were a little bit tainted in this, and the players are taking a hit, you know, vis-a-vis an ownership group that is largely multi-billionaires.
Yeah, the owners are losing money. The owners already have been losing money. So that's, you know, but I'm not crying for them. There's no violin small enough to play for billionaires who are overwhelmingly willing to put down $200 million for an expansion fee to get into a league, where that $200 million basically just means they have the right and opportunity to start a franchise that will almost guaranteed lose money every year. It's kind of a crazy thing, but, a thing that I often say on the business end of soccer is that you don't own the team because you expect it to turn a profit. You own the team because you expect it to appreciate like a fine Picasso or a house in a really dope neighborhood, like Lodo, right? Like you buy it because you think because people are going to want to buy it for more in 10 years. So anyways, the players take a little bit of a beating, but they get a surety that, they're going to play, that there's going to be, a contract, that there's going to be money. I haven't looked at the specifics of the deal because I don't think it's significantly changed from the deal that they had originally ratified, other than a 5% cut, I think was the number that I saw.
7.5% for the season.
Nice. Thanks, yes. Matt. Well done.
Thank you.
I mean, soccer's back on, I think, is the most important thing. We leapt the final hurdle. It looks very good as long as Florida doesn't screw this up. for the ESPN Wide World of Sports to have soccer, that's the complex, not the actual name of the company, but for them to have some soccer going on. I saw my favorite, joke from today that was related was, the overhead picture of the complex shows a bunch of baseball fields. The question being, does NYCFC have to play there?
So, that's, That's a good one there, Mark. No, and I think, you know, certainly there was no scenario really for me in which the players declining this or ultimately games not being played that wasn't going to be worse for them financially. So they could say, you know, okay, we're not getting the same amount of revenue. Part of the metrics that we determine how much you get paid is based on an expectation of revenue, and that revenue is not there. So, okay, like, yes, you don't want a 7.5% pay cut. If you vote to not have this happen and we don't do the Orlando mini tournament, and that doesn't put in things in motion for you guys to all come back after that tournament and actually resume some form of regular season that has, you know, TV revenue, potentially reduced capacity crowds and everything in there, you know, then there's no revenue, in which case then we have grounds to say you're not getting paid, or at the very least, if we go to arbitration or some form of legal battle, you're going to end up taking a pay cut that's more than 7.5%. So I think, as I said in a banter topic a couple shows ago, Mark, as long as it can be safe and the parties agree to it, non-zero soccer, both from the integrity of the league, the opportunity for fans to actually watch, and for the, you know, the well-being of the players from a financial standpoint, non-zero soccer will always be a better option than no soccer. And so I'm glad that that's happening. There was one other thing to point in, Mark. I can't remember the actual language of it, but it's effectively, it's an out clause in the event of like an act of God. Did you read about this at all?
I read a lot about acts of God, but those are different.
Okay. So, let me look it up. Let me look it up in a second, but, in any case, it's a legal clause that it mostly exists in contract law. But effectively it's an out in the event that there's an act of God. So for example, Mark, if your house, God forbid, gets hit by a meteor, you still don't owe the mortgage for the entirety of it. You know, there is an out for, you know, either party to invoke or for both parties to invoke. And then there's a couple contingencies upon which this can be activated. There was initially a concern because the league was putting in a condition for this to say if 5 teams in MLS see a reduction in average attendance of 25% from their previous year, and we know San Jose and their county has pretty strict guidelines that basically say the Quakes can play games, there aren't going to be fans there. We've seen the Canadian markets put in similar things, like all we really need is one market to get really scared, and it doesn't take a lot for you to drop down to less than 25, you know, to 20, you know, only 75% of the number of the gate receipts you were getting in the previous year, and basically that would automatically activate it, and that would accrue a bunch of other financial cuts that the league was going to put in, and pay cuts ultimately for players. We've now found out that that is not going to be the case, so there's still contingency plans in the event the second wave comes back. God forbid if everything that's going on with the protests and everything turns out into an outright race war, that shuts down cities. I would assume that would give the league, that would give the league and players out for that, but there's less of an automatic trigger in that makes things a little bit simpler for, players and everything. Mark, talk a little bit more and then I'll try to find this, this actual term that I was looking up.
Oh, I don't have any great opinion. I just generally think that, we should hope for the best. I feel like things feel really bad right now in America, but we are on the come up. Maybe we've reached the bottom. Maybe. I don't want to prognosticate too much, but I do feel like odds feel like it can't really get any worse than this, right, Matt? I mean, the murder hornets, if the murder hornets really do arrive, an asteroid. There was an earthquake today in California, a buddy told me. So, of course, we've really hit everything.
Yeah, I think, well said on that front, Mark. I can't find this thing. Why is Google not giving me an answer here? I apologize, listeners, for wasting your time on this.
We waste your time every week, listeners.
Okay. Oh, Majure,
Force majeure.
Force majeure, yes. So that is there's a clause now in the CBA for the rest of the 2020 season that if, you know, act of God, something else happens that suspends the season, either party, the MLSPA or the league, can initiate that, and then that would allow them to renegotiate or basically deal with it ad hoc in the actual moment. And so one of the clauses that the league put in a previous iteration of the deal that they put to the players was basically if five of the 26 teams in MLS at least have an average attendance of 25% less than they had last year, so only 75% of what they were selling for the entire 2019 season, that would automatically activate the force majeure, and basically the league could tear up the deals that they had for 2020 and renegotiate and potentially really pinch the players financially. That is not the situation. Anything that else would happen would have to be much more significant than that and on a larger scale in order for them to evoke that. But in any case, listeners, we have a resolution. Soccer is going to happen, and the league is putting themselves in a position where potentially all the teams are going to be back after the Orlando COVID Cup, and then in a position to resume the season of some sort that will be on TV, possibly with, you know, restrictions, but allowing maybe, I would doubt it, but potentially fans in the stands as well, with social distancing and maybe reduced capacity or only season ticket holders on certain days or any case. But the point is, this was the, you know, if the players returning to individual training with the opportunity in the near future to have full team training sessions, players and the league and ownership agreeing this, that we're going forward with this, they're going to be games, we are going to schedule them. This is the, you know, that was the previously, you know, the players getting to practice was a small step. This is a massive leap forward in terms of us actually seeing MLS at some point in the rest of 2020, potentially also in Commerce City, Colorado. We had an Ask ACHL mark that we will finish out the episode with in regard to this. It comes from Matt Cleveland. Matt, hello. Hope you are staying safe given everything that's going on in the world. So Matt asks, the Lawless Abubakar trade involved a 2020 international slot. I believe it was only for 1 year. Yes, it was only for the 2020 season, Matt. And with the current situation going on, if we do get the roster spot, the international roster slot back next year, then we made out like bandits in this trade, and there's a very reasonable case that Columbus could file a grievance and get some spot next year too. How do you think this plays out in the scenario with the Orlando experiment happening, and what if it doesn't? Thanks for keeping us entertained during these crazy times. So in any case, Mark, this kind of just generally speaks to the market's completely blown up on this front. We have no idea what the rest of the season looks like. Presumably, teams were going to go into the secondary transfer window, which was set to start July 7th with, you know, a half season's roughly worth of data on how good their team was, what was going on with injuries, or potentially only getting the two games played at the beginning of the season, and then maybe anywhere from 3 to at most 10 games, I would assume, from the Orlando mini tournament before that wraps up and you now have to make decisions. Teams were potentially saying, okay, we're going to make this move now and we're going to deal with it in the secondary transfer market. This is in the midst of the league also blowing up what TAM is. Everything just becomes GAM. Who knows what the secondary market looks like in terms of trying to bring in another DP, even though that doesn't necessarily affect the Rapids. And what does this do to the valuation of an international roster slot on the entire market? And I should point out, Mark, at the top in the first paragraph of the MLS roster rules and regulations, the final sentence is, the league reserves the right to at any time at the league reserves the right at any time to modify the roster and budget guidelines, create exceptions to the roster and budget guidelines, and or rescind the roster and budget guidelines in the league's sole and absolute discretion. So basically, Mark, if you know, the first rule that you make shows your values. So if we're talking about the founding fathers in America, one of the things that they valued the most was freedom of speech, freedom to peacefully protest, and freedom of the press. The most important thing about Fight Club was to not get the word out about Fight Club. And the most important thing to MLS is there are no rules. They make up the rules and they can change them at any time. This seems like a great opportunity for them to account for the force majeure and actually account for the fact that this is a completely different situation. We should change the dates and the circumstances of the secondary transfer window, allow teams to file grievances given potentially they had plans to make a move to be solvent that now they're not going to be able to move, maybe dish out some temporary, you know, sell off some temporary international roster spots that expire at the end of the year for a certain amount of GAM back to the league and everything. I realize I'm ranting. Mark, how should the league be dealing with this in the context of the situation? And Matt's question.
I love Matt that Matt asked maybe one of his longer winded kind of wind ups for a question for me to give this unbelievably craptastic answer. I don't know. I can see it both ways. On the one hand, you make a deal and you kind of know that like the deal could end up being a total disaster all around, right? Like when the Rapids traded Sam Cronin to Minnesota, Minnesota thought they were going to get one of the best defensive midfielders in the league, and they did until he had a concussion like 7 games later. And that's not on either team. It's just the way the cookie crumbles. It's the way sports go. So on one hand, you could say all of these international slots that have been traded, you know, buyer beware. In the event of a pandemic that wipes out the season, it doesn't change the expiration date. And that would be a fairly logical, and I would guess, I'd say 70% odds on that being the case, that we just play out this year as if every international slot deal, every player who is being taken in the college draft, you know, super draft spot, they're all just, we're keeping the terms of the deals the same, because otherwise it's total chaos. The alternative is to say all the international roster slot deals are unfair because nobody really got use of those slots this year. Therefore, we're pushing it. And to that point, I don't know if Matt, you explained this fully, but basically the deadline that teams needed to be roster compliant with the international roster slots hadn't quite hit yet because it was another 2 weeks after the pandemic struck or something like that.
Like a month ago is when the primary transfer window, which opened up January 1st, officially opened, and teams had until then to be solvent. And we've had no games since then. We're only going to have a handful, and then you're going to have like 2 months to be solvent again with potentially all of the season still to play.
Right. So to that end, you could very much easily say, it's not fair, let's just wipe this, let's just push everything back 1 year. If you borrowed an international slot for 2020, it's now pushed out all the way to 2021. I think there's a 30% chance of that happening because someone could say, well, it's not fair, we traded away a perfectly good player and got this international slot, which we didn't even get to use. There's a lot of fairness to that statement. Another way to do it, if the league wanted to be crazy, to your point about making up the rules as they go, is to kind of like expand the number of international slots for next year. But, you know, to make up. But that actually kind of is hurtful in the sense that, like, if you were desperate for an international slot and you gave something valuable away for it, you're now being given one for free, and maybe you never would have needed the international slot in the first place. I don't know, man. Honestly, that's probably the one situation where it's a series of bad choices. There's like no good option.
Yeah.
I think that first option of that's the way the ball bounces, that's the way the cookie crumbles is probably the best way to handle it.
Yeah, I could definitely see, I could see them at least moving the transfer window dates, Mark, if nothing else, just because everything that's going on with, we don't even know when the actual start of the European season's gonna be. And so, you know, is UEFA gonna push back, or are individual leagues gonna push back that, you know, because basically it's in Europe, everybody's got to finish by July. We're saving August from the international tournaments, and then it's like 2 weeks and then back into the season. So you're talking about like 6 weeks off, maybe, for the English clubs, for example, before having to start their season. And normally it's, you know what, I think Labor Day weekend is usually that Monday or that final day in August is when they close their window, having just played a couple games in the season. So I feel like everything's going to push back. I could definitely see them changing the dates, or at the very least expanding the actual window. And I could see them putting in some form of softening up of, you know, we will make a certain number of temporary international slots available to teams to buy for the rest of the season from the league. We're like, the league is a bank, and we're going to, you know, the league is the Federal Reserve. We are going to hand you out an international roster spot. You give us a certain amount of allocation money to account for that. If you want it, you can buy it. You can't trade it or something like that. Something to just soften the situation and acknowledge the hardship that clubs are going through or the fact that things weren't unplanned. I think that's more likely, Mark, than them making a decision either to expand the, extend the transfer of assets to an additional year instead of just saying, you know, we are going to allow for, we're going to soften up the market by making more supply available. If you want it, you need it, great. If you don't need it, fine. And then all of this expires and we're just going to reset for 2021 because at that point there'll be a vaccine, maybe the market stabilized, and we'll be okay from that front. But I could see the league, maybe not on a individual basis like Columbus saying, well, you know, we didn't know, we weren't able to use that roster spot. We want another roster spot. In terms of like them filing a grievance and them going to arbitration and maybe winning something from the Rapids, so much as the league just saying, we're going to soften the rules. Here's stuff that's available to you if you want to see access to it. But I mean, you know, Mark, if we're talking, you know, like late June, early July that teams are finishing up in Orlando and coming back, having another 2 weeks of quarantine and training and then resuming the season, like you're talking about playing 5 games, maybe 10 games at the absolute most before the secondary transfer window opens. That's absolutely crazy just in terms of, you know, Pork and the front office trying to evaluate the current state of the team and what they might need. Or, you know, God forbid with all the games they're playing in Orlando, there's a bunch of injuries and then your club's completely decimated. So I definitely think the dates of the secondary transfer window need to be moved, Matt. Matt Cleveland, to your point, I don't know if there's going to be an opportunity for the league to act as a third party in an arbitration disagreements given the circumstances, but I could definitely them just saying, we're going to rip up some of the restrictions that you have because this is a force majeure act of God, and we're just going to make it easier for every single club to deal with this. That's going to extend through the end of the season. We might keep some of them for 2021, and then we'll return to some form of normalcy. I think that's a better out than either the idea that Matt's question was suggesting or your point, Mark, of just completely, completely change, not doing anything. I think that does it for us, Mark. Shall we get out of here?
Let's go.
Okay, listeners, if you want to give a little bit of love to our sponsors and you are in the financial situation to do so, or you just want to add some, bookmark some tabs for later when the paychecks come back, I want to thank our first sponsor, Roughneck Scarves, the official scarf supplier of MLS, USL, and US Soccer. Get your custom scarves or non-medical mask for your group or team, and you can customize it at roughneckscarves.com. And then, if you're looking for soccer jerseys and you are tired of the same old uniforms and cookie-cutter templates you get from the big boys, you can look for a unique and completely custom kit for your club, Sunday League squad, adult team, or even just your quarantine squad. Icarus SC can help you create the kit of your dreams at an affordable price with their motto, quote, any design you want seriously, end quote. Let them help you design the custom kit for your club today at IcarusFC.com. Listeners, follow us individually on Twitter at @soccer_rabbi and at @LWSMattPollard. Check out our soccer musings at American Soccer Analysis and at Last Word on Soccer. Hit us up on the socials at Rapid96Podcast. Send us your questions using the hashtag AskHTHL. We might dedicate a whole segment of the show to it. We might dedicate a series of 5 weeks worth of Twitter polls to it. And then if you want to get in further touch like Matt did, email us at Rapid96Podcast@gmail.com. Listeners, we'll see you next week. Please stay safe. Please stay sane. Take care of yourself and maybe somebody else. We'll see you then.
Peace.